End footnote. You're producing a more intense combustion that smelts iron ore, just like your smelter did, but this goes further. The iron reacts with the carbon in the stack, forming a new alloy with a melting point down near 1200 degrees centigrade, low enough to melt in your furnace. The high-carbon liquid iron runs out the bottom and cools, and you've got your metal. But it's not quite steel. The problem now is you've got too much carbon in your iron. You want it between 0.2% and 2.1%, and the output of your blast furnace can be as high as 4.5%. This high-carbon iron, also called pig iron, is brittle, too easily broken if bent or stretched to be useful in bridges or buildings, but its low melting point does mean you can pour it into molds and cast frying pans, pipes, and so on. This cast pig iron is called cast iron, and you just invented it. To reduce the carbon level of pig iron enough to make steel, you'll be using the Bessemer process, whose basics were discovered in East Asia in the 1000 CE. The idea then was to blow cold air across the molten metal, and the more modern version, patented in 1856 CE by, you guessed it, some guy named Bessemer, is to force air through the liquid pig iron instead with bellows or air pumps. The air introduces oxygen to the mixture, and the oxygen reacts with the molten carbon to form carbon dioxide. This either burns off or bubbles out, leaving a purer iron behind. And as a bonus, these reactions also generate heat, which heats up the molten metal even more, allowing the reaction to continue even as the melting point of your liquid metal rises. Footnote. Other impurities, like silicon, also form oxides, and these will sink to the bottom as slag. Here's a tip. If your iron ore contains phosphorus, and a lot of iron ores on Earth do, so maybe, your steel won't be as strong as it could be. To solve this problem, toss in something chemically basic. Hey, there's limestone again, with your ore. It'll react with the phosphorus to form more slag at the bottom, which not only gives you a better steel, but when the phosphorus-rich slag cools, you can grind it up and use it as fertilizer. End footnote. It's very hard to know when precisely to stop bubbling the air to get just the right amount of carbon remaining, so don't bother. Just burn off all the carbon you can, producing a pure iron, and then mix whatever carbon you want back in. Iron is the sixth most abundant element in the universe and the fourth most common element in the Earth's crust. But until humans invented blast furnaces and the Bessemer process, it was impossible to turn it into steel cheaply or efficiently. But you've just figured that out, and now one of Earth's strongest metals is also one of its cheapest. Nicely done. Once your civilization has engineers in it, they'll definitely thank you for that one. A final note on steel. You can produce high-quality steel wire by taking advantage of steel's high tensile strength and using a technique called wire drawing. All you do is make a rough wire out of steel and then pull it through a cone-shaped hole, as so. And here we see figure 33, an apparatus to draw wire as seen from the side. It's simply a cone-shaped hole that steel is being drawn through, producing a thinner steel wire on the other side. This produces a wire of consistent area and volume, and that unused mass goes into lengthening your wire. By using several progressively smaller holes, you can produce wires much thinner than you can make by hand. A ratchet, see Appendix H, can be used to pull the steel forward, and conveniently, this can all be done at room temperature. You just need some lubricant. Here's where it gets embarrassing for us. In the early 1600s CE, grease or oil was used, but this required softer steels, and too much friction would cause the wires to break. By 1650 CE, one Johann Gerdes accidentally discovered that if a steel was soaked in urine for long enough, a soft coating would eventually develop, we now call this process corrosion, which worked to reduce friction when drawing wire. This process, named sol coating, was used for 150 years, until someone noticed that diluted beer actually worked perfectly fine as a substitute. And it was only around 1850 CE that anyone thought to check if water works too. It does. It works perfectly. Do better than we did. Don't soak your steel in pee for over 100 years for no reason. 10.10.3. Welding. When I told my father I was going to be an actor, he said, fine, but study welding just in case. You. Also, Robin Williams. What it is, a way to fuse two metals together in a way that can actually be stronger than the base metals. Before it was invented, Any metal item had to be forged as a single piece, because once it existed, the only way to join it to another one was with bolts and screws, which are much weaker than a good weld. Originally invented, 4000 BCE for forge welding, 1881 CE for arc welding, and 1903 CE for torch welding. Prerequisites, metal, forges, electricity for arc welding, and acetylene for torch welding. How to invent? Forge welding is easy. Just heat the two metals you want to weld to about 50 to 90% of their melting point in your forge, at which point they're flexible but still solid. The challenge is when metals reach this point, their surfaces tend to oxidize, which prevents a good weld. By sprinkling sand, or ammonium chloride, or saltpeter, or a mixture of all three, see Appendix C, on top of your metal, you solve this problem. They lower the melting point of the oxides, allowing them to flow out from between the two metals as you beat them together. Beat them together, you say? Yes. This is not a fancy form of welding, hotshot. This is the form of welding where you heat two metals up and hammer them together until they stick. If your arms get tired, you can use a water wheel, section 10.5.1, to produce a mechanical hammer that will strike your metals repeatedly. If you have electricity, section 10.6.1, you can invent electric arc welding, a less labor-intensive version that also lets you weld items too big to fit in a forge. Arc welding uses the heat generated by electricity arcing from an electrified piece of metal, called an electrode, to the metals you wish to weld. The electrode is placed near the point on the metals you wish to weld, and the arc jumping from it causes them to melt and fuse together. A rod of a filler material can also be used to join your two metals together, which can make the weld stronger than the base metals themselves. Just ground your metals, bring an electrode close enough to arc, and weld away. Footnote. To ground something, run a wire that travels from it to a conductive piece of metal inserted into the ground. The earth conducts electricity, and this gives electric current a path to dissipate safely. Without a grounding wire, electric current may reach the ground by traveling through your body instead, which you'll want to avoid, because that's what being electrocuted is. End footnote. Try to keep the distance your arc needs to jump consistent, otherwise the current it carries will fluctuate, which alters the heat, and therefore quality, of your weld. Needless to say, this option can be insanely dangerous, especially if you're stranded in the past and have never worked with electricity before. Footnote, there are other forms of welding too, but they're even more dangerous and probably a bit beyond your current means. Torch welding, melting metals with a flame, lets you not only weld but also cut right through metals, but it requires an extremely hot torch. Burning acetylene gas in pure oxygen is hot enough, 3100 degrees centigrade, but producing acetylene requires dry distilling coal to produce coke, combining it with lime at 2200 degrees, which is hotter than conventional fires can reach, but which can be achieved by building an electric arc furnace, which is exactly what it sounds like. And then combining the output of that process, a powder called calcium carbide, with water. That reaction produces acetylene gas, but also heat, and since acetylene gas is explosive, it can be a pretty delicate operation. End footnote. You'll probably want to stick with heating up metals, dumping some sand on them, and hammering them until they stick, for the time being. 10.11. There's nothing to read. Regardless of whether they're made from paper or electrons, or recorded words, books are critical to civilization. Obviously, the guide you're currently reading makes that case literally, but even books of fiction are vital. They are, after all, the stories humans write about themselves. Paper is the technology that will turn trees into the thin, flexible, easily burned substance upon which you will commit all your discoveries and achievements to posterity. It's also good for wiping your bum. Once you've got it, printing presses are the machines on which the knowledge of your civilization will be distributed, debated, shared, and stored. They are an absolutely transformative technology and critical for any civilization that wants its ideas to have wide and affordable distribution, reliable reproduction, and the ability to survive outside the limits of fragile mortal bodies, which, we regret to inform you, are precisely the kind of bodies you're stuck with. 10.11.1. Paper. There have been great societies that did not use the wheel, but there have been no societies that did not tell stories. You. Also, Ursula K. Le Guin. What it is? A cheap thing to write on. Before it was invented, people wrote on the skin of animals, aka parchment, which meant that if you were alone and wanted to write a book, you first had to either raise or hunt down an animal and then slaughter it, which obviously slowed the creative process down just a little bit. Originally invented, 2500s BCE for parchment, 300s BCE for paper in China. End note, the exact date that paper was invented isn't actually known. There's a lot of myths surrounding it, and the credit for paper is traditionally given to a man named Kowloon, who lived from 48 to 121 CE. However, there's archaeological evidence of paper predating even that date, including some dating as far back as 179 BCE. All the research I found suggests the date here is, at best, an informed guess. And end note. 500 CE for toilet paper in China, and 1100 CE for toilet paper in Europe. Prerequisites: fabric or metal to produce a fine mesh screen, wood, rags, or other natural fibers, water wheels for grinding pulp, sodium bicarbonate or sodium hydroxide, optional, but it speeds up pulping, pigments, also optional, but you'll probably want ink once you have all this paper lying around, see section 10.1.1, charcoal. How to invent. Before you invent paper, you can jot down notes on animal bones, strips of bamboo sewn together into scrolls, parchment, if you've got the time and inclination to dehair skins and stretch them until they've dried, see section 10.8.3, silk, if you've domesticated silkworms, wax tablets, you can get the wax from bees or by boiling fat in water, letting it cool and using the waxy stuff, which is tallow, that solidifies on top. You can write on clay tablets, which you then fire if you want the information to stick around, see section 10.4.2, or on papyrus, see section 7.16. But these media are all heavy, awkward, expensive, hard to transport, or some combination of the above. What you really want is something light, convenient, cheap, and ubiquitous enough that even if it doesn't literally grow on trees, it's at least made out of their ground-up bodies. What you really want is paper, which gives your civilization not just books, magazines, and newspapers with the printing press, but also unlocks playing cards, paper money, toilet paper, paper filters, kites, party hats, and more. The basics of paper making are pretty simple. You'll be taking plant fibers, breaking them up, and then reforming them into thin sheets. Anything with cellulose in it will work, and as all plants that photosynthesize produce cellulose as part of that process, it's one of the most common organic compounds in the world. One large tree can be transformed into upwards of 15,000 sheets of paper, but there are a lot of other sources for cellulose too. Old clothing and rags, for example, will also make great paper, either on their own or as a way to bulk out wood fibers. Heck, you could have made paper from the lint you collected from your dryer back in the future where dryers were a thing. The first step to making paper is to produce pulp, which is done by breaking your raw material into small pieces, for example, turning your wood into chips or tearing your rags into shreds. You can let them soak in water for a few days to get the fibers loosened before grinding or beating your plant fibers down into, well, a pulp. To speed this process up, you can add sodium bicarbonate or sodium hydroxide, see appendices C.6 and C.8 respectively, to your water and simmer your wood chips or rags in there, which chemically separates the plant fibers. Footnote: this process breaks down the lignin in your plant fiber. Lignin is an organic polymer that binds plant fibers together, but it's also what causes paper to turn yellow with age. Less lignin in your pulp means you may have to add some glue to make your paper stick together better, but you'll get a whiter and stronger paper as a result. End footnote. Once you've got a watery pulp, stir it to get the fibers moving, then drag a mesh screen through it. You can make it with either metal or threads, see section 10.8.4, which will collect some of the fibers in a flat layer. Flip your screen upside down to remove the pulp, press it to remove the water and force the fibers together, and let it dry. You've just made paper. And once you've used your paper, you can recycle it by repeating the same process. Just tear your paper up again, break it down into fibers, and press a new sheet. Civilization pro tip: the basic papermaking process, breaking down plant fibers, layering them on a screen, and drying them out, hasn't really changed in the thousands of years since paper was invented. Even though you're hopelessly stranded in time, the paper you're making will still share a connection with all the other paper on the earth you left behind, which has at least a non-zero chance of making you feel at least marginally better. While paper was invented in China around 300 BCE, the means of its production were kept a closely guarded secret to prevent other civilizations from benefiting from it. By the 500 CE, paper in China had become so routine that people were wiping their bums with it, thanks toilet paper, but it would still take more than half a millennium before Europeans would learn of its invention, let alone rub it on their dirty, dirty poo bums. It wasn't until 1857 CE that toilet paper was first produced commercially in the United States, before any old paper could be used and tearing pages from books was not uncommon. It was only in 1890 CE that toilet paper was sold in rolls instead of in stacks. To make going to the bathroom more comfortable for members of your civilization, and to prevent them from resorting to cleaning themselves with wool, rags, leaves, seaweed, animal furs, grass, moss, snow, sand, seashells, corn cobs, their own hands, or a communal sponge on a stick, you'll want to consider inventing toilet paper ahead of schedule. Footnote. All of these have been used at different points in history, but the Romans did that last one, inserting a sponge on a stick through a hole in front of the toilet between their legs, which let them wipe without having to stand up. Give the sponge a quick rinse before you use it, and you're good to go, assuming you have no idea that germs are a thing. End footnote. 10.11.2. Printing presses. The preaching of sermons is speaking to a few. Printing books is talking to the whole world. You. Also, Daniel Defoe. What they are. A way to disseminate information en masse, both quickly and cheaply, which is great if you want to get into the dissemination of information en masse business. Before they were invented, books were extremely expensive, so only rich people read them, which meant that all the non-rich people who might have come up with amazing ideas if only they could metaphorically stand on the shoulders of giants found that they couldn't. And so civilization wasn't becoming nearly as great as it could have if it were harnessing the full potential of every brain within it, which is complete baloney. Footnote. This metaphor dates back to 1159 CE, where one Bernard de Chartres expressed the idea in a bit more loquacious form. We, modern humans, are like dwarves perched on the shoulders of giants, the ancients, and thus we are able to see more and farther than the latter. And this is not at all because of the acuteness of our sight or the stature of our body, but because we are carried aloft and elevated by the magnitude of the giants. This image of accumulated knowledge raising everyone up is so powerful and expressive that humans haven't stopped talking about it for 1,000 years. End footnote. Originally invented, 33,000 BCE for stencil paintings of hands, 200 CE for woodblock printing, 1040 CE for movable type in China, 1440 CE for movable type in Europe, and 1790 CE for the rotary press. Prerequisites: pigments for ink, see section 10.1.1 charcoal, paper for printing, pottery, optional for building letters, metalworking to build the press, though this is technically optional and they can be built out of wood, and glass for eyeglasses, so that everyone can read papers, even the farsighted, who might not even realize they're farsighted until you ask them to read tiny letters on paper held in their hands. How to invent. If you've got pigment, which you can get from charcoal in section 10.1.1, and you've got something you can cut, like paper, but even large leaves work, then you can make stencils of words, and therefore mass-produce books, in any time period you care to name. Footnote. This involves making a different stencil for each page of your book, and cutting in each letter of each word by hand, but it works. And once you have the stencil, you can easily make copies until your stencil wears out. End footnote. The earliest stencils humans ever made were of their hands, and some of them survived on cave walls into the modern era. If only someone at the time had thought to invent writing, those same ancient humans 35,000 years ago could have used stencils to carry their ideas, their beliefs, their hopes, their dreams, their successes, their failures, their stories, and their legends into the modern era, instead of just making a record of what their hands look like. And in case you're wondering what human hands looked like 35,000 years ago, we can tell you with absolute certainty. They looked like hands. We didn't even need a time machine for that one. Stencils work okay for printing, but it's hard for fine shapes, which means your books are going to be large print, plus you need some form of spray paint. Early humans used their mouths, You can use pigment blown through a tube with a nozzle on the end using the bellows described in section 10.4.2. To avoid these problems, you may want to skip ahead a few tens of thousands of years to woodblock printing, first invented in China around 200 CE. This involves carving an entire image in reverse onto a single block of wood, which is then coated in ink and pressed onto papers, silks, or anything else you care to print on. Footnote: printing like this could have been invented much earlier, around 500 BCE. Certain maps in ancient Greece were carved into metal plates. This was for prestige, or to make them sturdy enough to survive on long journeys. But if more than one copy of a map was needed, then a duplicate was carved into a second metal plate. In other words, the Greeks had everything they needed to invent printing, including the presses, which they used to make olive oil, and could have easily done so, had but a single person thought to duplicate their metal maps by spreading ink on them before pressing them to papyrus. None did. End footnote. Woodblock printing works great for art, but for language it has several downsides, not the least of which is how hard it is to correct a mistake. Mess up on a single letter and you may have to recarve your entire page out of a new block of wood. Nobody's got time for that, and this slow, labor-intensive process means producing a book takes years. And even once you've carved out every page for your book, you still face a challenge of storage. A 2.5 centimeter thick piece of wood means you need over 404,128.224 cubic centimeters of storage space for this book alone. For writing, you'll probably want to jump straight ahead to movable type. Here, rather than carving an entire page, you instead produce stamps of individual letters, which you put together on frames to create a stamp for a whole page. Besides solving the problem of storage, you'd only need to hold on to tiny letters instead of giant wood pages. It also rewrites the economics of printing. Arranging the letters into a page takes minutes compared to the weeks or months required to carve a page out of wood, so books can be produced more cheaply and a much greater variety of books could be printed. Before movable type, most of the texts being printed were religious texts, things that didn't change and that had a huge, enthusiastic, and sometimes legally mandated audience. After movable type, anyone with enough money to pay for it could print anything, which set off one of the largest cultural changes civilization had seen until the invention of the internet hundreds of years later. Movable type existed in China around 1040 CE, but it really only took off when the technology reached Europe a few centuries later. This was due to another innovation, the alphabet. Chinese writing used not a small set of letters representing sounds like phonetic languages do, but rather a large set of characters representing ideas, with more than 60,000 different characters found in a single book. Each system of writing has advantages and disadvantages, but Chinese's disadvantage when it came to movable type was significant. It's a lot cheaper and easier to keep and sort through a set of 26 different letters than it is of 60,000. Footnote: of course, no printer would have only 26 different characters. Printers would store multiple copies of each character in compartmentalized wooden boxes, type cases, where they'd be kept alongside punctuation, spacers, and other characters. Capital letters would traditionally be stored in a separate case on top, the origin of calling them uppercase and lowercase letters. End footnote. The letters you'll be printing, your type, can be carved from wood, but this has downsides. Wood wears down with regular printing, its grain can sometimes show in the final result, and wood distorts when it absorbs printing ink. Fired clay was used in China and produces strong, durable letters. You can print with either wood or clay letters, but you can also use them as prototypes for new metal type by pressing the letters into either fine sand or a soft metal, copper works well, and then pouring liquid metal into that impression. Printers eventually settled on a standard metal to forge type with, an alloy of lead, tin, and antimony called type metal that produces strong, long-lasting letters. Footnote: lead shrinks when it cools, which can distort your letters, but adding some tin and antimony produces an alloy that shrinks less and is harder once set. Different printers use different ratios, but a mixture of 54% lead, 28% antimony, and 18% tin was used traditionally, with a mixture of 78% lead, 15% antimony, and 7% tin being used for more durable type intended for longer print runs. End footnote. To typeset, letters are put together into a wooden frame. Footnote: If you think you may be reprinting a book in the future, you can make a metal casting of your page, quickly producing unalterable page-level duplicates that echo the woodcuts we discussed earlier. End footnote. Once the wood frame's completed, printing is done by coating them in ink and pressing them onto paper. To mechanize that, and to get equal pressure applied across large flat surfaces, you'll want to invent the screw press. The screw press is simply a giant vertical screw connected to a large flat surface at its bottom. Footnote. Screws turn rotational force, moving in a circle, into linear movement, digging in a straight line. They're easy to invent in theory, but in practice they need an even thread to work. Rather than just eyeballing it, make a right triangle, which you can read about in Appendix E, out of paper, section 10.11.1, and wrap it around a pointed cylinder, starting with the triangle's thinnest point. The shape made by the upper edge of the paper as it wraps around is a helix, which, coincidentally, is also the shape of a screw's thread. Engrave ridges around that helix line, and you'll produce a perfect screw. End footnote. Handles on your screw press are attached to the screw at the top, allowing the screw, and therefore the pressing surface, to be raised or lowered by rotating those handles, which transforms that easy rotational force into a stronger downward force. They look like this. So here we have figure 34, a screw press. At the bottom there's a platform, and above that there's a flat pressing surface. The surface can move up and down by rotating a screw, which runs through a support structure at the top of the platform. Figure 34 is labeled a screw press, an apparatus used in both printing and winemaking, though usually not at the same time. And as a bonus, once you've got a screw press, which is ordinarily invented around 100 CE, you can use it for all sorts of other things. It works for pressing wood pulp to remove moisture, which is useful when making paper, but it can also be used in tastier pursuits to press grapes when making wine, or to press olives when making olive oil. Attach it to something smaller than a large flat pressing surface, and you can use it to punch holes in metal too. An innovation that helped make printing presses as successful as they were was the substitution of water-based ink, typically made from soot, glue, and water, with oil-based ones, usually made from soot, turpentine, which you can get by distilling pine resin, and walnut oil, which you can get by pressing walnuts in that screw press you invented two paragraphs ago. Oil-based inks better adhere to metal type, and they don't soak into paper as deeply, which prevents words from becoming blurry. To ink your letters, you can dab them with a flattened ball of ink-soaked leather on a stick. The number of dabs controls how much ink your letters get, an improvement over simply dipping the letters in ink, which douses them in the maximum amount every time. But if you're smart, you'll invent the ink roller, which is a cylinder that can be rolled over your type to distribute ink. Footnote. Despite ink rollers being invented around the 1810s CE, paint rollers, which are the exact same idea but scaled up for walls instead of type, were only invented around the 1920s CE, which is an incredibly late arrival for an invention that's as simple as saying, "You guys, what if we put a furry cylinder on a stick?" End footnote. The faster your press can operate, the more books you can produce. Multiple people working together can operate a simple press at peak efficiency. Typesetters set up pages in advance, one printer coats the letters in ink while another feeds in the paper, while yet another lowers the press onto paper to produce the image. You just invented the assembly line. Your screw press will initially be powered by hand, but it's easy enough to adapt them to steam or electrical power when you have those technologies. And when you have the engineering to build it, you'll be able to adjust your press to be a rotary press, an invention that first showed up in 1790 CE. Here, instead of flat type being pressed onto paper, gently curved type is attached to a giant wheel, which rotates onto a strip of paper, pressing letters as it goes. While a standard printing press requires breaks as each new sheet of paper is inserted, a rotary press can operate indefinitely as long as there's enough paper and ink to feed it. Footnote. We say that rotary presses were invented in 1790 CE, but this was actually a European reinvention of a Mesopotamian technology that dates all the way back to 3500 BCE. The Mesopotamian invention, now called cylinder seals, were small cylinders with figures engraved in them. By rolling these cylinders over wet clay, their images were quickly reproduced. Cylinder seals were used in Mesopotamia for everything from decoration to signatures, but unfortunately, were never scaled up to mass-produce text. End footnote. The easiest thing to print at first will be posters. Notices that can be posted publicly, hence the name, allowing fast, cheap, and accurate mass communication across your civilization. Fold, cut, and bind poster pages together, and you'll produce books. And the more copies of a book that are printed, the more likely it is that information will survive across time. When printing becomes cheaper, it'll be possible to bind a smaller number of pages together on a regular basis to produce a disposable book, or magazine. These can take the form of scholarly journals that allow scientists to collaborate and share discoveries no matter where they happen to live, or as news and entertainment periodicals to help people stay informed of current events and celebrity bloopers. Printing will eventually become so cheap, in fact, that it'll one day be profitable to use the lowest grade paper to print single-use, disposable documents on a weekly or even daily basis, and these will be your world's first newspapers. The printing press will allow your civilization and the people within it to become their best selves, entertained, educated, informed, and up to date. So it's really great you thought to invent it just now. 10.12. It sucks here, and I want to go literally anywhere else. Without transportation, civilizations are small and constrained, unable to fully explore or benefit from the larger world around them. With transportation, however, they can expand, stabilize, and incorporate disparate geographic areas into a cohesive whole. Bikes are one such mode of transport, exquisite machines better suited to moving humans around under their own power than even their own legs. Compasses let anyone determine the direction they're traveling in, which pairs well with latitude and longitude, wherein each location on Earth is given its own coordinates. With them, anyone can determine their precise location anywhere on the planet. In the absence of clocks that work at sea, radio is the technology that makes longitude possible. Finally, boats open up the ocean to explorers from your civilization, and human flight does the same to the very skies themselves. Invent these technologies, and the people in your civilization will be able to go anywhere they want and find their way back home again. 10.12.1. Bikes. Let me tell you what I think of bicycling. I think it has done more to emancipate women than anything else in the world. I stand and rejoice every time I see a woman ride by on a wheel. It gives a woman a feeling of freedom and self-reliance. It makes her feel as if she were independent. The moment she takes her seat, she knows she can't get into harm unless she gets off her bicycle. And away she goes, the picture of free, untrammeled womanhood. You. Also, Susan B. Anthony. What they are. A way for human bodies to move themselves around with 3 times more efficiency than walking. We'll say that again. Humans invented a way to get around that's actually better than walking around on their own 2 legs. We've been dunking on humanity a lot in this book, mainly for taking a really long time to figure out some very simple stuff, but bicycles are a beautiful piece of technology no matter where and when you invent them. Footnote. Even if, yes, it did still take us thousands and thousands of years to dream them up, even after we had roads, wood, and wheels. End footnote. Before they were invented, we don't even want to talk about it. Originally invented, 1817 CE for the earliest self-propelled 2-wheeled tandem vehicles, you push them with your feet. 1860 CE for bicycles with pedals attached to the front wheel. 1880 CE for penny farthing bicycles with that giant front wheel and the tiny rear wheel. 1885 CE for the so-called safety bicycle that had 2 wheels of the same size and therefore much reduced the danger of flying off the giant front wheel of a penny farthing. 1885 CE, which was the first time an engine was attached to a bike, aka the first motorcycle, and 1887 CE, the first bike with a chain to power the rear wheels. Prerequisites. Wheels. Metal. It's optional for chains and gears. Fabric. It's optional for a drive belt. Or a basket, which is optional for a nice picnic. How to invent. Attach 2 wheels to a frame you can sit on, one in front of the other. Put pedals on one of the wheels so you can move this whole contraption with your feet. Add a seat in the middle. And make sure that front wheel can swivel freely so you can choose what direction you go in. Guess what? You've just invented the bike. It may not be the shiny metal one you're used to, but it doesn't matter. Some of the earliest bikes were built almost entirely out of wood. bikes will fundamentally transform society, allowing ordinary people to travel long distances quickly and easily, all under their own power. We're cheating a bit here. Bikes can get a little more complicated. The bike we've described above has the pedals connected directly to the wheels, so each rotation of your pedals corresponds to one rotation of the wheel. Unless your wheel is giant, you'll be pedaling a lot to move only a little, and there are two ways to solve this problem. The easiest option is to make your drive wheel bigger. That's where those old-timey penny farthings came from with that colossal wheel up front. But this results in a ridiculous but arguably awesome-looking bike with a very high center of gravity. You'll fall a lot, and you'll have a lot further to fall when you do. A better solution is to add one more wheel to your bike, a small pedal wheel that goes in the middle part of your bike at foot level, connected to a rear drive wheel. This way, you can add gears around that rear wheel, which changes the amount of work one rotation of your pedals does. These days, this connection is done through chains that fit around teeth in gears, but if you don't have metalworking yet, you can use a drive belt instead, a loop of fabric wrapped tightly around both the pedal wheel and the rear wheel. Footnote. Friction causes the movement of one wheel to induce movement in the other, but drive belts are inefficient. A lot of energy is lost to friction, and they can slip easily. Another early alternative to chains and gears were treadles, rods connected to the rear wheel that you push up and down to induce movement, similar to how you moved a spinning wheel in section 10.8.4. But if you've got the metal to produce them, chains and gears are more efficient and reliable. End footnote. If you go with both chains and gears, you'll want to invent the derailleur, which is simply a movable chain guide that rests between the pedals and the rear gears. When it's moved horizontally, it induces the chain up or down from one gear to the other, allowing you to shift gears while the bike is in motion. Without a derailleur, you'll need to stop your bike to adjust your gears manually, which you shouldn't feel too bad about, since it's what everyone did before the French came up with the derailleur in 1905 CE. Add some brakes, which is just a clamp that closes around the wheel to slow it down, and you've got the basics of the bicycle, the fundamentals of which haven't significantly changed since their invention. The bicycle is one of the few technologies that humans got almost perfect right off the bat. Improvements since then, like rubber tires filled with air for comfort and spoked tires for lighter wheels, have been evolutionary rather than revolutionary. And while they're nice, pneumatic tires helped bicycles lose their early nickname of bone shakers, they're not actually necessary. We said earlier that bicycles are more efficient than walking, and you can prove it to yourself by going for a walk and watching what your body actually does. Many of the movements you make don't actually result in forward motion. The forward swing of your foot is what moves you forward, sure, but that's only part of what you're doing. Your legs are moving up and down, wasting energy. Your arms are swinging back and forth for balance, wasting energy. The entire mass of your body is bobbing up and down, which, you guessed it, is wasting energy. On a bike, most of the energy you're producing goes towards pumping the pedals, and the vast majority of that goes towards producing forward motion. Footnote. It was once thought one of the reasons humans evolved to walk upright was because of how much more efficient it was for getting around, but that's not true. Human walking isn't even particularly efficient. Once you take their different weights into account, the efficiency of our walk is within 95% of what you'd expect when evaluating the performance of other mammals, including horses, dogs, mice, bears, platypuses, elephants, monkeys, and our nearest cousin, chimpanzees. In fact, the efficiency difference between humans walking on two limbs and chimps walking on all four is so unremarkable that you'll find larger differences between foxes and dogs, kangaroos and wallabies, and even within closely related species of mice, chipmunks, and squirrels. End footnote. And on hills, bikes are even more efficient, since you can coast your way downhill. Bikes enhance civilization in a lot of other ways, too. They allow people to cheaply commute, which means crowding in cities can be reduced. They allow moderately sized goods to be easily transported under human power, which helps not only farmers bring wares to market, but craftspeople and service workers to operate in a much wider area than they could reach on foot. And while you won't be achieving human-powered flight for a while, when we finally pulled off that trick in 1961 CE, it was with a human pumping the pedals of what was, in effect, an extensively modified bicycle. In our own history, bikes have also been fundamental to early women's liberation. While this will hopefully not be an issue in your civilization, You're starting on a better foot than we ever did, seeing as you don't have to labor under the hangover of thousands of years of patriarchy. It's worth noting how something as simple as giving people the ability to cheaply transport themselves under their own power changed European society in the late 1800s CE. This newfound mobility not only allowed women to participate in civilization in ways they couldn't before, but actually changed the way women saw themselves. They were no longer observers moved around by society. Instead, they were active participants who could, and would, move themselves. The clothing women wore also changed in response to the bicycle, as demands for a new rational dress that allowed for a modicum of physical activity meant the end of restrictive corsets, starched petticoats, and ankle-length skirts that had previously been worn. Besides her simplicity, affordability, and civilization-altering utility, and virtuoso-like efficiency when paired with the human body, bikes are also just a heck of a lot of fun to ride. You can even put a little basket on the front and fill it with a bottle of wine, section 7.13, some nice breads, section 10.2.5, maybe a cozy blanket, section 10.8.4, and even some tasty pickles, section 10.2.4. Is it any coincidence that a guide to reinventing civilization also functions pretty well as a guide to having a really delightful picnic? Picnics are objectively one of the crowning achievements of humanity, and don't worry, by following our instructions, you'll get there eventually, on the wheels of your bike. And here we have figure 35. It shows a bicycle. At the front is the steering wheel with spokes labeled, attached to the handlebar. The pedal is at the middle of the bike, attached to a wheel labeled as the pedal wheel, which is attached to the back drive wheel by either a drive belt or drive chain. A seat sits above the pedal wheel. The entire figure is labeled Figure 35, a beautiful machine. 10.12.2. Compasses. The winds and waves are always on the side of the ablest navigators. You. Also Edward Gibbon. What they are. A way to know what direction north is in, which also tells you what direction you're facing. Before they were invented, it was very easy to get lost because it turns out that an invisible, global, wayfinding signal that you don't even need electricity to access is actually extremely useful. Originally invented 200s BCE for fortune-telling, 1000s CE for navigation, and 1200s CE for European navigation. Prerequisites? Rope, which is optional. How to invent? The first compasses were invented in China around 200 BCE. To make them, all you need is some magnetic rock, which conveniently naturally occurs near the Earth's surface. Look for rocks that stick together, and you'll find magnets. Footnote: if you can't find any magnets, don't worry. If you've got a small amount of metal that can be magnetized, like iron, you can induce a magnetic field in it, turning it into a magnet by repeatedly rubbing it through your hair in the same direction. A needle-sized piece of iron will work best here. And of course, if you've got electricity, see section 10.6.1, you can create magnets whenever you gosh darn feel like it. End footnote. Once you've got one magnet, you can use it to find more, and can even use it to make new magnets from scratch by magnetizing other things made of iron. Footnote. Repeatedly rubbing a magnet against iron in the same direction will transform that iron into a magnet even faster than rubbing it through your hair. End footnote. These early compasses weren't the needle on a pin encased in plastic ones that you remember. Instead, they were as trivial and basic as tying a rock to a string. The string lets the rock rotate freely, the rock moves to point north, and you have just invented the compass. If you don't have string, just put a tiny piece of your magnetic rock on a leaf and float it in a pool of water, and you just invented the compass twice in one paragraph. The catch is that these early compasses were used for fortune-telling, not wayfinding, and it took more than 1,000 years, until the 1000s CE, for anyone to think of using them for navigation. Europeans took even longer to figure this out, which means there's plenty of room for you to blow some minds here. A warning. The Earth's magnetic field reverses occasionally, flipping north and south. These reversals occur unpredictably every 100,000 to 1 million years, and can take between 1,000 to 10,000 years to complete. While north and south are just labels you'll apply to arbitrary poles of the planet's magnetic field, during these times of reversal, the strength of this magnetic field can drop to only 5% of normal. This, needless to say, will make compasses more difficult to use, So if you find yourself in the middle of one of these reversals, maybe don't depart on any transoceanic voyages for a bit. Here's when they happen over what, for us, are the past 5 million years or so. Here we have figure 36, magnetic pole reversals over the past 5 million years. There are several areas in which the magnetic poles are reversed. The ones in particular to look out for are between 1.06 and 1.19 million years ago, where there's a brief flip back to normal before it continues reversed all the way back to 1.78 million years ago. There's other large gaps between 2.14 and 2.59 million years and 3.59 and 4.17 million years ago. There'll be some other reversals, but you'll know them when you come across them. As you can see, we are actually overdue for a magnetic field reversal in the modern era. This was a minor concern until pole stabilization technology was invented in the early 2040s CE, at which point nobody ever had to worry about it ever again. Except now, for you. Sorry about that. 10.12.3, Latitude and Longitude. I think you travel to search, and come back home to find yourself there. You. Also, Chimamanda Ngozi Adichie. What they are. A way to precisely define every location on the planet with just two numbers, reducing the question of where am I to the mere task of figuring out what those two numbers actually are. Before they were invented, directions were local rather than universal, more turn right at the big tree and sail west until you hit land, then these coordinates describe a location to the accuracy of 10 centimeters. Originally invented, 300 BCE for the first geographic coordinate system, 220 BCE for quadrants and astrolabes, 1675 CE for ineffective marine chronometers, 1761 CE for more effective marine chronometers, and 1904 CE for time signals being transmitted over radio. Prerequisites. You'll need the calendar for solar latitude and radio for longitude. How to invent. If you assume the Earth is a sphere, it's not, you can cover that sphere in horizontal and vertical lines. Footnote. The Earth's rotation causes the planet to bulge out around the middle, which transforms it from a perfect sphere into what's technically known as an oblate spheroid. But the bulge isn't that big, and assuming Earth is a sphere makes the math easier. And we're all about making things easy for you, the involuntarily stranded time traveler who once tore through time at their whimsy, but who is now restrained, like everyone else, to traveling through time in only one direction, forward, and even then at the fixed rate of 1 second per second. End footnote. Arbitrarily label the horizontal ones latitude and the vertical ones longitude, and you've invented the planet's first geographic coordinate system. That was easy. Footnote. Again, as in all things, you can name these lines whatever you want. If you'd like to outperform our own history, we'd recommend not giving these two confusingly similar lines the same confusingly similar names. Call one latitude and the other Gary. End footnote. Here we have figure 37, two spherical approximations of Earth that someone drew all over. Latitude lines are a series of horizontal lines wrapping around the globe, and longitude lines are a series of vertical lines wrapping around the globe from pole to pole. Since the Earth rotates, it has a natural top, bottom, and middle. Footnote, where top is on a map, or on the entire planet, is actually entirely arbitrary. We're used to north means up, and that's what we use in this text, but an upside-down map is just as accurate, so feel free to choose whichever orientation you think is prettier. Fun fact, the appearance of maps used thousands of generations from now may well be determined by whatever choice you make in the next few seconds. End footnote. We'll call the line around the middle of the planet the equator, define that as 0 degrees, and label every other latitude line by whatever angle a line drawn from those latitudes to the center of the Earth makes with the equator. So latitude lines will start at 0 at the equator, and they'll increase as you go north until they reach 90 degrees at the North Pole, and decrease as you go south until they reach negative 90 degrees at the South Pole. For longitude lines, also called meridians, there's no obvious vertical equator to make your zero point, so you're about to do what every other human throughout time has done when faced with this problem. Shrug, and pick one at random. In the modern era, everyone uses an imaginary line passing through Greenwich, England as a zero point, also called the prime meridian, since at the time that was the path of least resistance. England had already printed a lot of maps with that feature. But different nations have used different prime meridians passing through their favorite cities instead, and it really doesn't matter what you choose. We'll label longitude lines slightly different from latitude. Latitude lines are treated as rings, each latitude line wrapping around the entire planet like a belt. But lines of longitude are treated as half circles, each meridian defined by the curve you get when drawing a line between the north and south poles. This means that instead of ranging from negative 90 to positive 90 degrees, like latitude does, longitude will range from negative 180 to 0 degrees for places east of the prime meridian, and from 0 to 180 degrees for places west. Your final coordinate system will look like this. Here we have figure 38, an image of a sphere with lines of longitude and latitude drawn on them. The north pole is at 90 degrees, and the south pole is at negative 90. Between it is the equator at 0 degrees latitude. Longitude runs from the north and south pole. Between the north and south pole, we have the prime meridian at 0 degrees, and other meridians going up or down, whether you go west or east. This is labeled figure 38, a bunch of lines that have suddenly become a robust system of latitude and longitude. Now that you've given each location on the planet a precise coordinate, all that's left is to figure out some way to know the coordinates you're standing at. Footnote. For example, time travel was first successfully demonstrated at 43.66015 degrees latitude and negative 79.395196 degrees longitude when a small mass was sent back in time 250 years for 3 seconds before being retrieved. For such a momentous achievement, the experiment itself is famously calm and restrained, except, of course, for one moment near its end. When the mass returns, researcher Bennett suddenly realizes that the first successful instance of time travel is, by its very nature, also going to be one of the most famous moments for time travelers. Almost despite herself, she glances around the room to see if any future time travelers really have come back to witness it. Her reaction, if you then choose to step out from the shadows, makes this one of the most popular choices in our Earth's Most Wild and Wacky Moments in History tour program. End footnote. For latitude, you'll use the stars to measure your position. You may be thinking, oh yes, I have heard of a North Star used for navigation by sailors, so I'll just use that. When you consider the matter, your next thought will be, oh no, I just remembered that while the Earth spins like a top, which causes days, it also wobbles like a top too, which causes a rough 25,700-year cycle we call axial precession. Because of axial precession, any imaginary lines drawn up from the North Pole or straight down from the South Pole will appear to sweep across the cosmos in a giant circle, meaning any star used for navigation in the modern era likely won't appear to be in the right place in the sky in whatever crazy time period I'm stuck in, and that's a huge problem, made worse by the fact that the stars themselves are all moving slowly over time. And yes, that long and incredibly detailed thought you're having is correct. While you might recall in your pre-time travel life looking up to the sky at night and finding a North Star if you're in the Northern Hemisphere, or a South Star if you're in the Southern, the position of these stars is not guaranteed. And without knowing precisely what time period you're in, relying on them is impossible. However, there is one star, visible from Earth, that is always going to be where we want it, no matter what time period you're surviving in. And that's our star, the Sun. Measure the angle between you and the sun at noon, when it's highest in the sky, and you'll still be calculating latitude using the stars. For this, you'll need a quadrant, which is just a quarter of a circle with angles marked on it. In other words, it's just half the protractor that you can download on howtobendeverything.com. Here's a template. Make yours out of wood or metal. And here we see, figure 39, a quadrant template. It's simply a quarter circle with angles marked from 0 to 90. At the triangular point, there's a point where a plumb line is attached, and a sight line runs from the plumb line all the way to the edge of the circle. Attach a rock on a string to the corner. This is your plumb line, and it will always point straight down, assuming you can protect it from the wind. At each edge of the sight line, make 2 loops. When you stare through the sight line, lining up your quadrant so the sun appears in the middle of both loops, Your plumb line indicates the angle you've got your quadrant at, which also happens to be your latitude. Take several readings and average them for more accuracy, and latitude is now a solved problem. Or at least it would be if staring at the sun long-term didn't cause irreversible blindness. The quadrant you've just invented is great for navigating by the stars, but if you're using the sun, you'll want to adjust it to allow for indirect solar observation. Here's how. Replace the loop near your plumb line with a block of wood, with a tiny hole in the middle, and replace the other loop with another block of wood with a target drawn in its center. Now, instead of looking at the sun, you'll align your quadrant so the tiny pinprick of light passing through your block is positioned directly in the middle of your target. Ta-da! Now nobody has to go blind just to sail a boat anymore. There's one final adjustment to make. If you're using the stars, they're far enough away that they appear fixed from Earth's perspective, so you don't need to adjust for the planet's axial tilt. But the planet's tilt does affect where our sun appears in the sky, so you'll need to adjust your solar readings per the following table. So here we have table 14, showing equinoxes and solstices. There are five columns: event, season, how to recognize when this event is taking place, approximate date, and adjustment required. There's a footnote on approximate date. How can you know the approximate date if we haven't told you how to invent calendars? The answer is simple. Build your calendar around these equinoxes and solstices. Time the length of your days and nights, see section 10.7.1 clocks, and you'll know when the equinoxes and solstices have occurred, which lets you build a calendar around that to predict them and the changing seasons next year. If you're so inclined, you might even go so far as to make your calendar visual, perhaps by positioning rocks such that the sun rises perfectly between them only on the morning of solstice, constructing some sort of Stonehenge. We've used the Gregorian calendar and Julian months you're familiar with here, but you don't have to stick with them. Call your months whatever you want, and make them whichever length pleases you. Like the prime meridian, they're also completely arbitrary. The only scientific restriction on your calendar is that it should average out to 365.256 days per year, but you can get that average however you want. We do it by having 365 days per year for 3 years, and then throwing in an extra day every fourth year with a few leap seconds here and there to pick up the slack. But there are other solutions. End of footnote. Going back to the table, the first event is the March equinox. The season is spring in the northern hemisphere and fall in the southern hemisphere. There's a footnote here too. Footnote. Determining what hemisphere you're in is easy. Just build a large pendulum, 12 meters or longer works, and let it swing for a few hours or so. A pendulum's inertial frame is separate from the Earth's, which means with a long enough pendulum, like the one you just built, you can actually make the effects of Earth's rotation visible. The path your pendulum takes will rotate over time, clockwise in the northern hemisphere, counterclockwise in the southern hemisphere, and none at all if you're at the equator. A gentleman named Léon Foucault came up with this idea in 1851 CE, but it's yours now. End of footnote. So again, going back to our table, we have the March equinox, which is in spring in the northern hemisphere or fall in the southern hemisphere. You can recognize this event when day and night are the same length. Its approximate date is March 20th, and no adjustment is required. The next event is the June solstice, which is in summer in the northern hemisphere and winter in the southern hemisphere. You can recognize it by the longest day and the shortest night of the year in the northern hemisphere, or the longest night and the shortest day of the year in the southern hemisphere. Its approximate date is June 21st, and the adjustment required is to add the axial tilt, which is 23.5 degrees in the modern era, but likely different in yours. The next event is the September equinox, which is in fall in the northern hemisphere and in spring in the southern hemisphere. It's when day and night are the same length. It usually occurs around September 23rd, and no adjustments are required. The final event is the December solstice, which is in winter in the northern hemisphere and summer in the southern hemisphere. You can recognize it by the shortest day and longest night of the year in the northern hemisphere, and the shortest night and longest day in the southern hemisphere. It happens around December 22nd, and your adjustment is to subtract the axial tilt, which again is 23.5 degrees in the modern era. That was table 14, labeled, "The latitude adjustments required when using the sun." On Earth, anyway. We forgot to mention this until now, but any time machine is by necessity a space machine too, and any trip through time without corresponding movement through space will leave you stranded elsewhere in the cosmos, since Earth is moving through space around a sun that's moving through space in a galaxy that's also moving through space.